Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Gary Borger, and he'll be answering your most important questions on designing trout flies. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. If you have to leave early, you can return to the website at your convenience and listen to the shows and broadcasts at any time. Content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or the transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Gary Borger about designing trout flies. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. Keeney's Fly Shop has an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com, that's K-I-E-N-E.com, or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. Again, that's 800-400-0359. Well, before we introduce Gary tonight, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. And for our drawing, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, which is always a great gift, and then a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. Magazine of Calgary, Canada, that's also being distributed quite extensively now in the U.S. So you have two chances to win, and if you haven't registered yet, go to for the drawing, go to our homepage, and just below Gary's section, it says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and then you'll be registered for the drawing, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a third gift, a $20 gift certificate, which can be redeemed for any merchandise at Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado, either in their shop or online at their website, www.frontrangeanglers.com. And here's how you're going to win. You must be the first person to answer a question we ask at the end of the show. I'm going to pick something out of what Gary talks about tonight and ask a question about that at the end of the show. And if you're the first person to submit the correct answer, then you'll win that $20 gift certificate. Now, when you do do that, you submit your answer through the text box on our homepage, right where the same place that you would ask other questions during the show. So listen carefully, and we'll see if somebody gets the right answer at the end of the show. Our guest tonight is Gary Borger. Gary has a PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he is Professor Emeritus of Biology at the University of Wisconsin campus in Wausau, where he taught for 28 years. During his teaching career, he taught botany, zoology lab, natural history, photography, writing in the sciences, ecology, taxonomy, and other topics, and he was presented with Teacher of the Year Award on two different occasions. Gary is one of the world's foremost fly fishing educators. He's been a fly fisher since 1955, and since 1972 has taught classes and lectured internationally in all aspects of fly fishing for trout and salmon. A freelance writer and photographer and an active member of Outdoor Writers Association of America, Gary is also Midwest Field Editor for Fly Fisherman Magazine, Editor at Large for the Virtual Fly Shop, and Fly Fishing Columnist for North American Fly Fisherman. He has written 5 best-selling books on fly fishing, nymphing, naturals, the Borger Color System, Designing Trout Flies, and Presentation. Gary Borger pioneered fly fishing video instruction with his release of Nymphing in 1982, and since then he's appeared in 4 videos for the 3M company, and in cooperation with the Federation of Fly Fishers, produce environmental video, Where the Trout Are. His video production company has produced an additional 17 internationally acclaimed videos in the Skills of Fly Fishing series. In addition, he's appeared in TV productions on ESPN, OLN, and Gary is also a consultant on Robert Redford's movie, A River Runs Through It. Gary Borger currently works as a consultant to Scientific Anglers 3M. He's a founding member of the Board of Governors for the Federation of Fly Fishers Fly Casting Instructor Certification Program, member of the Order of the Jungle Cock, Trout Unlimited, United Fly Tires, the Federation of Fly Fishers, and many more that we don't have time to list tonight. So welcome, Gary. You've got a lot of credentials. I think I only got through about half, but I think that'll do most of us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roger. I can't wait to hear what I say. It was very impressive.
You were impressed with yourself, huh?
I don't normally sit down and look at all that stuff. To me, it's just work, you know.
Yeah, you're just doing what you do, right?
That's right.
It all seems to add up over the years, that's for sure, though.
It does.
Well, tonight we're going to talk about designing trout flies. And, folks, we're going to first kind of start at the beginning. And I think it's like a chicken and egg thing, whether it's the bug or the fish, which comes first. But we'll have Gary sort that out, and then we'll talk about where these designs come from, how they originate, how they evolve, and then also some tying tips and things like that as we get to the end. So if you do have any questions, be sure and submit them, like I said before, in that text box on our homepage. We'd love to get your questions in during the show, and we'll do our best to answer them. Well, Gary, you know, your background is in biology in the university. Mm-hmm. How has that been helpful to you in your designs and creating flies over the years?
Well, probably the biggest advantage that I have as a designer because of my education is the ability to access scientific information pertaining to insects and trout behavior and then reduce that from the scientific into the angling world. Other than that, you know, as a biologist, you don't really gain a great deal for designing flies or tying flies. That's sort of separate from the biology. Anybody can learn to design flies and learn to tie flies. As I say, my greatest gain was the ability to access information knowing scientific names and go find scientific names in the literature and be able to read about life histories and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But
well,
most of that, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, doesn't that the study of the insects and so forth and their life, their habits and life cycles, that's got to be helpful to you in creating design.
It is, but, you know, a great deal of that has been reduced to the angling literature by people like myself and many others over the years that have written about the various life forms that fish feed on. So most of this information is now readily accessible to the angler without need of scientific training, which makes it really, really wonderful because we're seeing a great number of new designs coming along and more people becoming active in the design of flies to match specific insects or to those that were just used during non-selective periods.
Well, that was the next question that came up. Is there a need for more flies? Sounds like there still is, huh?
I mean, hey, there's always a need for more flies.
I mean, we must have thousands of designs out there right now representing only a few handful of insects here and there, right?
Yeah, I would say thousands of patterns and probably hundreds of designs, because what I consider design, for example, a V-wing mayfly is a design. And then you can think of all the different flies that are tied as patterns that would have a V-wing. For example, a royal wolf is a V-wing and an Adams is a V-wing. But other than that, they're exactly the same design, a tail, a body, a V-wing, and a hackle. So when we look at what I call core designs or design families, there aren't a large number of those, but there are a large number of patterns based upon the materials being used or the application of those materials in that core design process. And, you know, we're talking about the chicken and the egg, whether the fish came first or the fly came first or the bug came first or whatever it was. And I noticed a question that somebody sent in regarding that, the way in which trout feed relative to insects and so on. And I think before we even begin to discuss this whole concept of designing, we need to look carefully at designing for what, because fish feed both opportunistically and they feed selectively. So the designs that we try to create for opportunistic periods are different than the designs that we try to create for selective feeding. For example, in opportunistic times, there are two key elements that every fly needs to have, and that is motion and sound. It's at least if it's a wet fly, you know, not a dry fly floating on top. And I'll come back to that, the dry fly, in just a second. But for subaquatic flies, you need to have something in that fly that makes it look alive or sound alive to the fish. So typically when we think about subaquatic flies, we think of soft tackle flies as being very effective because the soft tackle moves on it. We think of things like a woolly bugger because it's got that big long tail that undulates during the, you know, when it's being retrieved, during the retrieve. And other flies like that are very attractive because of the motion that's in the fly. And the other thing that we have avoided for a long time in fly designing is the acoustic footprint or the sound that the fly actually creates when it's being pulled through the water. There is more work being done on that right now, especially as people branch out into saltwater angling and into warm water species, both temperate and tropical warm water species. These fish tend to be really keyed into the acoustic footprint of their prey organisms. For example, I fished in the Orinoco River system in Venezuela, and the water there is turbid. It's not dirty, but it's got a lot of organic material coming out of the tropical rainforests. And the fish there are highly tuned into the sound that's created by the prey organism, more so than the color, or more so than the size, or more so even than the movement. So if you have a fly that's got a lot of sound in it by making it very bulky, or by, heaven forbid, putting a spinner blade in front of it, or doing something else, a lip or something that would, you know, make it wiggle in the water and create some kind of an acoustic footprint, you get many more takes than you do if you just throw a fly out there that presents just a visual silhouette. So
well,
an opportunity. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say it when we, you know, we were both at the fly fishing retail show recently.
Yep.
And I can't remember, there's someone there that has created a new attachment for the front end of flies to create a waveform or something around the fly. Did you happen to see that?
Well, Mark Pettigene came out with something a couple years ago that's got a soft lip in the front that makes the fly wobble and swim. And there are other people now coming out with reverse hard beads, for example, that are flattened, sort of like a sequin or something that's in the front that causes the fly to wobble and flop around in the water.
Right.
Of course, the airplane propeller blades have been around for a long time. Those were used in flies in the 1920s and 1930s and 1940s. But for some reason, they fell into disuse after that time. But those are very important elements in the design of acoustic flies, those that create a lot of sound in the water.
Right.
But in the opportunistic period, we need something that is attractive to the fish other than in the sense that it looks like an insect the fish is eating, because during the opportunistic times, the fish are eating whatever comes along that looks good to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to trigger those chase mechanism because of motion, or the chase mechanism because they hear something that sounds like a wounded minnow, or, you know, something like that. The color can be important during opportunistic periods. For example, fishing for steelhead, they basically feed opportunistically. So a lot of times you're using fluorescent colors for the simple reason that fluorescent colors will fluoresce at depth, whereas other colors just all tend to turn black at depth. Below about 3 feet, we lose all of the red light. So red flies below 3 feet just look gray or black. But a fluorescent red fly below 3 feet still looks fluorescent red. So steelhead fishermen frequently use fluorescent colors because they're fishing at depth and sometimes fishing in somewhat turbid water, and the flies are much easier for the fish to see. Not only that, but fish, especially steelhead, tend to be turned on by fluorescent colors that may represent their need to pick up eggs or whatever it is. We're not really sure why they do that. The size can also be important. Remember the old adage, big fly, big fish?
Right.
Well, you know, that applies during opportunistic fishing. If you're out fishing size 20 trichos and you put on a size, you know, 6 leech, you're not going to catch much. But if you're just out there doing opportunistic time and you put on a black leech, yeah, maybe then you're going to catch some really nice fish.
Big meal for them then.
Yeah, a big meal. That's exactly right. So those kinds of things are all important in the consideration of designs during opportunistic times. During selective times, of course, then what we're trying to do is we're trying to match the size, shape, color, and behavior of the actual food organism or the stage of the food organism that the fish is feeding on them. And that's where fly fishing gets complicated, and that's where our chance for greatest success really exists, and also our chance for the greatest failure and frustration exists in that part of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, we do have one question here. Ted Hasselbring in Nashville, Tennessee. He says, Gary, it seems to me that being a keen observer on the streams and lakes is a prerequisite to being a good fly designer. Is this true? If so, how much time do you spend just observing, and what do you look for specifically? I guess that's kind of a broad range, but, you know, you're talking insects or minnows or whatever. But
that's right. Well, let's take it piece by piece here.
Sure.
You know, being a keen observer is important in anything that we do in life, and especially important in fly fishing, because oftentimes we tend to overlook things when we're not looking keenly and make assumptions. And when we make assumptions, we can run on into difficulties very easily. For example, you get down to the water and you see rings on the water, and immediately you see midges flying over the surface. You immediately assume that they're eating adult midges because you see rings, and so you stick on the Griffith's net because, boy, you like to catch fish and dry flies, and you fish yourself blind and don't catch anything. The problem was they weren't taking things off the top. They were taking them right under the surface. They were taking pupa, and when the fish came up and right underneath the surface, it makes the water hump up and it makes a ring on the surface. And so unless you're a keen observer and watching what's going on, it's very easy to say, oh, man, they're really selective today. Well, they weren't terribly selective. If you'd had a pupa on, you'd caught all kinds of fish. It's just that you missed the cues or the clues that were being given off by the fish, and instead of being a keen observer, you were just out there trying to make them bite your dry fly because you wanted to see them take a fly off the top. So you have to really pay attention to what's going on out there. Now, in terms of fly designing, yeah, you have to be a keen observer there, too, because you have to see what the fish is seeing, not what you're seeing. Again, from that same standpoint, if you went underwater and looked at what the fish saw on top, it would look very much different than what you see looking from the top down toward the fish. For example, the Griffith's gnat is a well-known fly that imitates the adult midge. In a size 16, I've caught fish on that and big fish on that thing all over the world. And you might wonder why a fly that's nothing but a peacock herald body and, you know, some hackle wound over is such a tremendous fly. Well, from the fish's viewpoint, when it looks at the surface looking at an adult midge, what it sees is the little legs touching the surface. It never sees the body because the body is way above the surface. Well, when you throw the midge out there, the Griffith's gnat, it looks the same way. The hackle tips keep the body up off the surface, and all it sees is the ends of those little legs there. And so it gives the right impression from the fish's standpoint. And bingo, away you go. So we need to think about what it is the fish actually sees from the fish's perspective and not from our perspective. And sometimes that causes us to have to do like Gary LaFontaine did, put on our scuba gear and go in the river and actually watch what's going on and look at it from the fish's vantage point, not from our vantage point.
Yeah, there's been many photographs taken trying to simulate that viewpoint from the fish's viewpoint.
That's right.
Yep. I'm not sure how realistic that is. What, you know, from the biology standpoint, what can fish really see? Can you explain that?
Well, yeah, a fish's vision relative to our vision is about like our vision relative to an eagle's vision. Now, the acuity of an eagle's vision is due to a larger number of rods and cones packed into the eye. They have about 8 times more than we do. So they have about 8 times the acuity we do, sort of like looking with 8-power, you know, binoculars. They can see that much more detail. Our eye is about that much better than a fish's eye. So they don't see in the very, very fine grain detail that we see in, but they can still recognize size and shape and color, and certainly they can recognize the behavior of the food organism, especially during these selective periods. And you have to remember that, now, most of the time we talk about feeding selectively, we're talking about trout, although some other fish might do that. But mostly we're talking about trout. And you have to remember that the IQ of a trout is about 6. Now, I don't know who it was that measured that, but you know, the scientific literature indicates that the IQ is about 6. So you're not fishing against an opponent with an IQ that's real high. You're fishing with an opponent that's locked into a specific food organism based upon, you know, the size and the shape and the color and the behavior of that food organism. So the closer our imitations are to matching what the fish sees relative to size, shape, color, and behavior, the more successful, therefore, our imitations will be. Now, again, when you think about it, you go into a fly shop let's say Rene Herb's fly shop up on Henry's Fork, and you look in there in the bins, and there's 5 different emerger imitations for the pale morning dun. And then you walk across the street and go into Mike Lawson's shop, and you look in there, and there's 5 different emergers for the pale morning dun. If you tied any of those on your line and went fishing, you'd catch fish on them, provided that you fished the fly correctly. So it's not just the fly, it's also the ability to fish it correctly. And sometimes flies are even designed to be fished in a certain way. So there's an interlocking between the angling skills, you know, the flies that are designed, what it is the fish that are seeing, what the fish are locked into during a particular hatch. And that's what makes it such a challenge, but also such a reward when you do get it finally figured out.
Well, it brings up a point like I was talking to Rim Chung down here. He's doing a fly tying demonstration, and he's famous for the RS2. Mm-hmm. And he ties, I think, one other fly. That's
yeah.
it. And he fishes those two flies and catches, outfishes most of the people he goes fishing with just those two flies.
Well, I'm sure he does.
And so that kind of tells you that what you just said is how you fish it has maybe much more to do with it than the actual pattern at times.
It does, a great deal. And depending upon where you're fishing, you could get by with one or two patterns. For example, if you're fishing on a tailwater fishery where there's, just tremendous midge hatches, you could probably get by just fishing a midge larvae or a midge pupae almost all the time and be very, very successful, because most of those fish are concentrating on those two stages, unless there's a super heavy hatch on, and sometimes they'll get up on top and feed on them. So, but depending upon where you are and what's going on, you can have flies that are very specifically tailored to the hatch, or like I say, you can have flies that are general in nature, fishing them opportunistically. So from the standpoint of observing it, it would be whether you're during opportunistic periods or whether you're fishing during selective periods.
But, as a fly fisher, you have to be opportunistic as well.
Oh, that's, very much so.
In other words, you could fish with the one fly, but there are opportunities for you to do a bit better and be opportunistic yourself by presenting something that really is attractive to them. So.
And the more experience you have and the more capabilities or abilities you have as an angler, of course, the better will be your chances no matter where you fish. For example, I have friends that just want to fish dry flies. They don't care whether they catch anything or not. They just want to fish a dry fly. That's fine. I have nothing against that. But I'd rather catch 25 fish in a day using a nymph than one fish in a day or two fish in a day using a dry fly. That's just the way I like to fish. So I can fish dry flies and nymphs and streamers and, everything in between, and do it for freshwater species and saltwater species and warm water and, temperate and tropical and all those different ones. Because the broader my range of experiences, the easier it is for me to recognize certain angler situations when they arise, and the easier it is for me then to lock in on what's going on and be able to take fish. That's my own personal, take on it. Other people would rather just fish a dry fly and enjoy being out for a day, and that's fine. I have nothing against that, and I don't think anybody should have.
That just leaves more fish for you.
That's right, more fish for me. I know. Right.
Well, Gary, we have to take a little break here, so we'll be right back, and we'll talk with Gary more about designing trout flies. Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects in both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help recovery of rare native trout, and the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and helped with the striped bass game fish 2006 symposium in Foxborough, Massachusetts last year, just to name a few. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give back something to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. And you can reach their website at www.fedflyfishers.org. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Gary Borger about designing trout flies. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as we can on the show tonight. I'm looking at some of these coming in here, Gary. This has to do with tying. Both of these have to do with tying, so we'll hold on to those for a little bit longer.
All right.
And get back to the design issues as well. We do have one that came in here from Scott Nelson in Portland, Oregon, that says, Dr. Borger, Oliver Edwards and some of Shane Stalkup's flies come to mind with this question. Are there any situations or conditions that merit a realistic or imitative style fly as opposed to a suggestive or impressionistic style? Just how effective are these highly imitative fly patterns on trout? They catch some fly fishers for sure, as they are pretty to look at.
Well, now that's a very interesting question, because the answer that I'm going to give you is going to sound a little bit weird. They need to be realistically impressionistic. How's that?
There you go.
Now, let me take the next couple minutes and explain what I'm talking about.
Okay.
We have to make a fly that looks to the fish enough like the thing that it's eating that it will think our fly, when properly presented, is the thing that it's eating. In my own design work, I try to reduce flies to the simplest common denominator. By doing so, I then discover what parts of the fly are important. For example, let's suppose I've taken an imitation of a pale morning dun, and I've changed the hackle color and fished it three or four different ways, and I discover that a certain color hackle, like a pale yellow hackle, tends to catch way more fish than any other color hackle that I use. Then I know that the color of that hackle is suggesting the yellow barring in the front of the wing, and that's a very key element in the design of that particular fly. Let's suppose I try four or five different materials for the wings, and I discover that something like the new SST materials turn out to be a much better winging material than anything else. Then I know that it's the light quality that I'm getting off of that material that's important in the design of the fly. So from the realistic standpoint, you don't need a fly that's got 10 body segments for the abdomen and two for the thorax or three for the thorax and a head and, you know, little antennae and all those sorts of things. The closer our fly looks like the real fly, obviously the better it is if it's giving the correct impression to the fish. So that's what I mean by realistically impressionistic. It's got to give the right impression to the fish. It can do that very simply. Maybe it's nothing but two or three pieces of material tied onto the hook in a certain form. Like the Griffith's net, for example, is one of those classic flies.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing to it. A body and a hackle. And yet that fly will outfish any other adult midge imitation day in and day out over the course of any season, any place in the world, simply because it gives to the fish what the fish thinks it needs to, you know, what it is seeing and what it thinks that fly actually represents. It gets a little bit more complicated than that in some situations, depending upon, you know, the color of the water and a few other things when we start talking about flies that go under the water. But the idea is that realistic patterns, if they are relatively simple to tie, are certainly fun to fish with. I wouldn't want to take 2 or 3 hours to tie a fly and then cast it up in a tree on the first back cast. So, you know, from the practical standpoint of tying your own flies, or from the practical standpoint of having a company that's manufacturing flies, if you're paying $5 and $6 a fly, or it's taking you 2 or 3 hours to tie one, is that extra effort actually going to catch you that many more fish? That's another question.
What do you
and
say?
So, what do I say? Yeah, I say that again. Sometimes the simplest flies catch the most fish because they're presenting the correct silhouette or the correct color or the correct whatever it is that the fish is keyed in on that particular hatch. In the selective period, they key in on size, shape, color, and behavior. And our flies have to have all four of those. Now, let me point out something.
That kind of answers the next question there with Ron Blanchard from Wyoming. What's the most important aspects of a trout fly? And you just illustrated that. So.
Yeah, from the selective standpoint, that is.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when we talk about opportunistic, probably the most important number one is movement.
Right.
And then probably size and color equal, and then if it's something that we're fishing after dark or trying to pull up a big fish, then sound probably gets involved in there pretty heavily. But from the standpoint of angling and fly design, you could spend a lifetime creating the most realistic-looking, easy-to-tie, best fly in the whole world, guaranteed to catch anything, and if it's not fished correctly, it's not going to catch anything. On a scale of 1 to 10, drag is 1,000. And by that I mean, everything else is less than 5 on a scale of 1 to 10. And by that I mean, I don't care how well the fly is designed. If you can't fish it, if it's like a dry fly, it's supposed to be floating on the top without drag, and you can't fish it without drag, you can't catch anything on it. Because fish are keyed into size, shape, color, behavior, and the behavior's wrong. Again, anglers think that they throw their fly out there and they think that the fish is so smart that it's got it all figured out. No, the fish is so stupid that with its IQ of 6, that if the fly doesn't do exactly what everything else is going to do, it's not going to bother wasting energy to eat it because it's not the thing it's eating. The other thing you got to remember is that big fish tend to be much more selective than small fish. And people often think that's because big fish are necessarily wiser, you know, they're older. So we think of older people being wiser, and we tend to anthropomorphize, that is, make fish be like people. We tend to have the Bambi syndrome, you know, the big brown trout's the wisest one in the pool. No, its IQ is still 6. But, you know, its body mass is enormously greater than the body mass of a small fish. For example, let's take a fish that weighs 5 ounces, or let's say 4 ounces, okay? We got a fish that's out there that weighs 4 ounces, and it eats an insect worth 40 calories. So that fish gets 10 calories per ounce of body weight. It's a 4-ounce fish, eats 40 calories, so 10 ounces per calorie of body weight. Now, there's a 5-pound brown trout in the same pool, same IQ, still 6. That 5-pound brown trout doesn't weigh 5 ounces, it weighs 80 ounces. It eats a 40-calorie insect, and it only gets 1/2 a calorie per ounce of body weight. So the small fish gets 20 times more food value per ounce of body weight for the insect than the big fish does. That means the big fish has got to eat 20 times more food for the same amount of food value, but not expend any more energy than the small fish. So small fish can afford to go racing around the pool, jumping out of the water, grabbing stuff, eating dry flies, eating nymphs, you know, eating emergers in the surface film, doing whatever it needs to do to grab food. It's not worried. The big fish, meanwhile, is moving this big old ponderous body around and trying to suck down these insects that don't provide much nourishment for it. So what the big fish has to do is position itself where there's a good food stream coming, and then when it rises, there better be something there to eat. Because if it rises to the surface and there's nothing to eat, it just wasted energy. When that happens in a heavy hatch, the big fish tend to concentrate on emergers, because there are far more emergers in the hatch than there are either the full-blown adult or nymphs or pupa coming to the surface. So when the big fish rises, there's an emerger, it just takes it, goes back down again, comes back up again, there's another emerger, it takes it, and it gets in a very, very rhythmic kind of cycle. In fact, you read the angling literature, they tell you count the number of, you know, seconds between rises and make sure your fly gets there right at the right time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's not because big fish, you know, are rising by the clock. They're just rising by a very cyclic method in which they expend the least possible amount of energy to take their food item.
It sounds like a lot of guys I know that when they're watching Monday night football.
Exactly.
With the chip bowl.
That's right.
Move as little as possible.
Routine. That's right. It's a bag of chips, a bag of chips, and a bag of chips, you know. So the concept there, see, becomes the understanding of what's happening with the fish becomes just as important as understanding what happens when you try to design a fly that looks, quote-unquote, like the food organism the fish is feeding on. Because if the fish is eating an emerger and you're fishing a dry fly or fishing a nymph, your chances of taking that fish are very low. But if you're fishing an emerger that's in the surface film that presents the right surface profile and suggests to the fish that it's eating, you know, your fly is the same thing it's eating, and your fly is behaving like the real thing, it's going to take your fly. It's just that simple. The problem comes in, number one, what's the fish eating? Number two, does my fly actually match it? And number three, am I fishing it in such a way that it looks to the fish like the real thing? And like I say, that's the key to being able to take fish, is being able to unlock those. And once you unlock them, then fishing becomes relatively easy during the hatch, and you figure it out. I mean, you can catch a lot of fish during a hatch when you get it figured out. Of course, you can also get terribly frustrated if you don't figure it out. That's part of the challenge of fly fishing, but also part of the great satisfaction of it.
Well, when just to kind of rephrase what you've been saying, it sounds like that during a heavy hatch, that you've got a more likely chance of catching a larger trout if they're feeding on emergers, to get them on emergers, that the larger trout probably aren't going to be coming up for the sporadic adults. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, that's probably true. If you got a heavy hatch, I always put the emerger on first. That's why I always do it. Just because there's more chance of catching more fish on the emerger than there are on the adult or on the nymph or pupa. That doesn't mean you can't catch fish on the dry fly, but
yeah.
And that big fish
don't
take
well. Or maybe the dry with a dropper emerger,
yeah,
right?
Sure, you can always do it dry with a dropper on there. That's always a good way of doing it. But the fish, the big fish, tend to concentrate on emergers during these heavy hatches simply because it's the most economical in terms of energy expenditure versus, you know, energy that you accumulate from eating the food organism.
Yeah. I think, you know, the description you gave of that, of calories, I've never heard anybody give that description before, but that sure makes a lot of sense to me. And you know, when you see these, you know, little 8-inchers go crazy.
Yeah, that's right.
And it makes you realize why you catch so many smaller trout as well, you know, because
yeah.
It just flat out is easier, and they're eating more and expending more energy to get to that. But
Now that brings up an interesting point. Let me just point something else at it, Roger.
Sure.
Most people just catch whatever takes the fly.
Mm-hmm.
So in the process of doing so, you're going to catch many more small and medium-sized fish than you are large fish, simply because there are many more small and medium-sized fish. In the process of doing that, you train yourself the skills necessary to catch small and medium-sized fish. Those skills are not as good as the skills necessary to catch big fish. So what you need to do is pretend that those small to medium-sized fish are big ones. Most people do anyway. They catch a 12-inch fish and it's a 16-incher every time. You know that. So, right? Or maybe even 18, depending on which one of their buddies is asking and how much I was on the bet, right?
Right, exactly.
Anyway, if they would pretend that those small fish were big fish and try to pay attention to their casting and to the presentation, to the make sure they're getting dead drifts and the leader design and all that sort of thing, and using the right fly and the right design, when the opportunity came for a big fish, they'd have the necessary skills to do that. And the only other, you know, other suggestion is to be move to New Zealand for all the fish come out of the egg at 20 inches and get bigger from there, and then you just catch big fish all the time.
That's what it seems like from
the
pictures,
right.
Huh?
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, going back to the IQ thing, it just made me think about, okay, so I've got a big trout down there. He's not going to move very much to get that food, or he's only going to move if there's a lot of food there, like with you know, the emerger kind of thing. Are they, you say, well, he's still got an IQ of 6. So you're saying that a larger trout, an older, wiser trout, is not more selective?
I'm saying that they are more selective in the sense that they're selective to the easiest to catch food item.
Right, they're not going to go out of their way, so you've got to get your presentation right on.
You've got to get your presentation right on. You know, the fly has to be in the right food lane. It has to be dead drift if they're taking emergers out of the surface mill, especially emergers or spinners, because they are going to go exactly where the current takes them. They're trapped in the surface film, and there is no chance for them to swim around or move or do anything like that. So, you know, if the current comes toward the fish and then jogs off to the left 6 inches and then jogs off to the right 6 inches, your fly better do exactly that. Otherwise, the fish simply avoids it because it would be a waste of calories from the fish's standpoint to eat something that is not doing what everything else is doing. Why chase it and spend energy? Why chase after it? You know, if it's dragging out of the way when all you have to do is open your mouth and take the thing that's right beside it, it's not doing that. So it's, you know, it's this whole concept of fly design, like I say, goes beyond just the materials you wrap onto the hook or what the final shape is going to be. You also have to think about the interplay of that design with the currents that you're trying to fish it in and the fish and the way they perceive food organisms and whether you're going for big guys or whether you're just out there casting for whatever takes the fly.
Right, right. Well, time for another break here, Gary. So,
all right.
Hang tight. We'll be right back and we'll have Gary answer more of your questions about designing and tying great trout flies. Well, our approach is simple, education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is only one of a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like shortline nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn more about how to fly fish. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Gary Borger about designing trout flies. If you'd like to ask a question, just go to our homepage and use the Q&A text box to send us your questions. You receive your questions immediately, and we'll try to answer them on the show tonight. And I'm just checking out there again, Gary. And all right. Okay. Some good questions coming in here. And, folks, we will get to those ones you sent online. Thank you very much for sending those in. But we're going to work those in here in just a minute. I've got a couple questions here from John French, Southern California, G.W. Foster in Oregon, dealing with color. And I know you've done a lot of work dealing with color. In fact, you wrote a whole book on that.
I did.
You know, one is a basic question, what's the best color for attracting trout? And then G.W. Foster says, first he thanks you for signing a copy of the great book presentation and for him at the 98 San Mateo show. His question is about colors for dry flies. When I tie mayflies, are the colors that important? I ask because over the years it seems like shape or phase and then size seem more important. So let's talk about color and what your thoughts are on the importance of color.
Sure. Trout do have color vision. In fact, almost all fish that live in relatively shallow water have color vision. It's a way for them to be able to distinguish their prey against what's called background space light. When we look at the sky is blue because blue light scatters more than the other colors. Underwater, blue light tends also to scatter more than other colors. So if you're underwater in a clear lake looking horizontally, not looking up, but looking horizontally, the water will appear sort of a silvery blue to you. If you're in a lake with a lot of algae, the water will look sort of a yellowy green, and if you're in a bog water, it'll look sort of reddish colored because of the different particles in the water absorb different amounts of light and different wavelengths of light. So a fish has color vision to allow it to distinguish its prey under those kind of circumstances. Otherwise, if it only had black and white vision, as soon as it dropped below about 3 feet, it wouldn't be able to see anything red, and dropped below about 6 feet, all of a sudden everything that was yellow would be gone, and so on and so on. So they do have color vision to allow them to be able to see their prey items. Now, as far as color goes, I started in 1962 investigating color in a rather intensive way. I kept track of the colors of all the food organisms that I could find that fish were feeding on, and tried a lot of different patterns and so on, and I discovered that they are indeed color sensitive. Not as color sensitive as we are. I mean, humans can see millions of colors literally. I suppose trout, from the standpoint of what they're capable of seeing, I would say certainly see thousands of colors. But when you begin looking at insects during any particular hatch, you notice that there are some a little darker, some a little bit lighter, some maybe are a little bit more mottled than others, and those sorts of things. So there's a little bit of leeway in there, a little range, spectral range in there, that you can cover and have your flies be quite consistently successful. From the standpoint of color during selective periods versus color during opportunistic periods, again, that's another whole story. During opportunistic times, again, you want something that's easy for the fish to see. It's going to be suggestive of something that they probably are used to seeing. One of my most favorite colors during opportunistic times is just black. A big old black leech or a big black nymph or even a black dry fly, simply because the profile is so strong that you can see it in any light. It doesn't matter what the water color's like, and it doesn't matter what the light's like. Fish will be able to see that thing. If the water's muddy, I tend to use a great big old black leech that's got a tremendous amount of bulk near the head so that when I pull it through the water, it also creates a strong acoustic footprint so that the fish hears that, rushes over, sees that thing, and gobbles it up. During selective times, I try to get my flies relatively close to the same color as the ones that are actually eating. Now, let me point out something very interesting about this that, you know, I've got, you know, enough stories about color, we could fill up a whole program just on that. But, for example, I'm fishing on Armstrong Spring Creek, and there's a pale morning dun hatch going on. The pale morning dun has a sort of a creamy green body with a yellow stripe on the front of the wing, a gray wing, and, you know, that's the dry fly. The nymphs, of course, are sort of a rusty brown. Well, this guy comes up to me and says, I don't know what all this fuss is about color. I'm just catching one after another on this parachute Adams. So I said, well, do you know what that parachute Adams actually represents? Well, no, but you know how trout are. They just like a parachute Adams. It doesn't matter what they're taking. I said, well, that's not exactly true. What do you think a parachute Adams actually is? Well, I don't know. And I said, well, it's an emerger. And he goes, what? This is a dry fly. I said, no, look at the design of the fly. Where's the hackle? Well, the hackle's above the body. That means that the body has to be under the surface when the fly is floating. The hackle's on top, and the wing is sticking up. And it looks exactly like an emerging mayfly. The nymph husk is under the surface. The legs are sticking out on the surface, holding the insect up. And that little white post sticking up looks like the insect as it's popping up out of the nymphal husk. So during any hatch, you could fish plain old gray parachute atoms and catch one fish after another. In fact, the world's most popular dry fly is a size 14 parachute atoms, simply for that reason. It is the universal emerger. You could use it during a mayfly hatch, a caddisfly hatch, or a midge hatch and take fish on it. It's very, very effective. But if you made it slightly more the color of the actual nymph, of the insect, it probably would be even more effective. So there's this whole thing about size, shape, color, and behavior. Some people say, well, the size is more important, the shape's more important, the color's more important. I could give you instances when each one is more important. For example, up on the South Platte, not too far from where you are, right there between the Spinney and 11 Mile,
right,
and that wonderful piece of water up there in South Park, there's a tremendous hatch of bright green midges right after the trichos. Anything you put on that's bright green and throw out there, you'll get a look. If it's the right size and shape, they'll take it. So we know it's that bright green color that's triggering the fish's primary, it's the primary trigger that's causing them to come and look at the fly. So color can be very important. A steelhead, for example, everybody understands that steelhead colors can be extremely important. For some reason, in the wintertime, the bubblegum pink flies just tend to knock steelhead crazy. And nobody seems to know really why. It's just that during the wintertime, they seem to like bubblegum for some reason, Maybe they could chew it to keep warm. I don't know. But anyway, the color can be a very, very significant part of the attractiveness of the fly to the fish. Here in the Lake States, for example, when the big browns come in the fall and when the kings and the cohos are in, we use a fly that's a brilliant purple with a fire orange head, a leech-style fly, and it will outfish any fly 5-1. So the color is significant.
And yet that represents really nothing natural.
And really it's not representing anything natural, but for some reason it triggers something about their chase instinct or their strike instinct, and they just take it.
That basically what you're describing is an egg-sucking leech pattern kind of thing?
Well, it's sort of like an egg-sucking leech, but more of a little fuller body.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. We don't use a hackle on it. We use just a body that we spin in a dubbing loop that's a little bit fuller, a little bit more bulky.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, basically the same kind of design, right?
Well, there's some of these things about color that we just can't figure out, I guess, as well. I mean, when we did a show with Kelly Gallup, and he's talking about his streamer patterns and fishing
mm-hmm.
streamers along the rivers and streams along the banks, and
yep.
how he will work a color for, I can't remember how many minutes, and then he'll switch up. And,
yep.
And today it's white. Yesterday it was yellow. Same pattern, different color, but for some reason today everybody's hitting a different color.
Yeah.
And there's no real rhyme or reason to it that we can figure out, I guess.
No, and the only way you'd be able to do that is, put fish under exactly the same conditions and exactly the same temperatures and exactly the same flow conditions and same turbidity and all
Which
these other
possible.
Things. Yeah, yeah, you can't really do that. So.
Yeah.
Again, that's part of the charm of fishing is, having those flies and tying those flies and switching up and figuring those kinds of things out.
It can be really exciting
when you turn them on.
Yeah, yeah. Earl Schoenberg in St. Louis sent in a question on the Internet here. He says,
okay.
And this has to do with color, if all flies show up as black or gray below 3 to 4 feet, why does a black or zebra midge size 20 to 28 work when fished deep? What does the fish actually see?
Well, I think they're just seeing that strong profile, that's coming down.
So it could be red, purple, or green, and it wouldn't make much difference when it's down that deep.
If it's below 6 feet, yeah, probably, although I think black probably would still show up a little bit better, depending upon how much red's in the fly. If it's a very dark red, it might appear as strong a silhouette as a black fly.
Mm-hmm.
But 6 feet, flies that are blue, for example, would show up. Some people like to fish fluorescent flies when they fish that deep, or they fish a little bit of flash on the fly, a zebra midge tied with a little bit of flash on it, or a beadhead. The reason those flies work so well is that down at that depth, anything below about 3 feet, they're very easy to see. They've got a tiny bit of flash in them. And any light that's incident at that depth will reflect off the surface of the fly. That's, like I said, fluorescent colors. Fluorescent colors will fluoresce the same color at any depth because they take in color at one wavelength and emit it at their fluorescent wavelength. So fluorescent red, for example, will take in blue or green or yellow and make it turn it into red light and output it as red light. So it doesn't matter what color it is. If it's fluorescent, it'll stay that color all the way down. And for that reason, a lot of anglers, especially when they're fishing big flies, will switch over in lakes and so on, will switch over to fluorescent purples or fluorescent blues or fluorescent greens and do very well at depth with those.
What about the angle of sunlight? Does that affect the perceived color?
Well, the angle of sunlight can affect the perceived color simply because the more light there is in the water, you know, the brighter the color will appear. Early morning and late evening, you're not going to get as much light penetrating the water as you would during midday. On the surface, it's very interesting that in evening light, insects lying on the, you know, spinners, for example, lying on the surface can appear red-colored to the fish rather than the natural color, simply because their wings act like windows to the outside world, and they're letting in the longer wavelengths. If you notice it about an hour before dark, photographers call it the golden hour. The light shifts from the blue of the day to a more yellow, and as we go toward evening, it shifts further and further and further into the red spectrum because the sun is penetrating more and more of our atmosphere as it goes around, you know, as the earth turns. More and more of the atmosphere is exposed to the sun, and so as a consequence, there's more red light coming through. Well, because that's happening, insects' wings will shine that red light through. John Goddard and Brian Clark had a tremendous photograph in their book, The Fly and the Fish, from underwater of these insects lying on the surface in the evening, and they were all bright red. There's a fly they use in England called the sherry spinner, and nobody could ever figure out why a sherry-colored fly worked when there was an olive insect on the water. And the reason it did was because the wings of the insect allowed the red light to come through, and these things looked sherry-colored rather than green-colored, the olive color. Now, having said that, maybe I shouldn't tell you this. I'll give away one of my secrets. A fluorescent orange spinner fished during an evening spinner fall will catch way more fish for you than one of the natural color, simply because it's showing that red that the fish are seeing. And it is a very strong red, and it's almost like a primary trigger mechanism. They see that, and they just, if it's the right size and so on, boom, they're going to take it.
Interesting. Now, I think that is that must be a closely held secret there.
Yeah, there's a song called Red Flies in the Sunset. No, that's Red Sails, and yeah. Right.
Red sky in morning, sailor take warning.
That's right. Red sky at night, fly fisher's delight. There we go.
There you go. Well, one of the we're talking about trigger mechanisms and opportunistic situations and so forth. And one of the questions that came in here on the internet is Brian Tracy in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Gary, do you feel that articulated streamers are more productive than non-articulated streamers?
Well, that's a good question because it depends on how the fly is designed. For example, if the material that's in the fly is soft and moves in the water, an unarticulated fly can show just as much action as an articulated fly. Generally speaking, articulated flies tend to be larger than unarticulated flies. And that tends to be more of a reason that the fish would take it rather than taking a fly that's unarticulated. You could achieve the same thing by tying it on a 15X long shank hook, but most people can't find hooks like that, and it's, you know, they're sort of weird and that kind of thing. So it's easier just to tie an articulated fly, join two flies together. Lots of times I take two flies out of the box and just tie one directly onto the bend of the other one immediately behind it to make an articulated fly if I don't have it, simply to get the size that I'm looking for more than the action that I'm looking for. If flies are designed with the right materials, they'll have a lot of action in the water. And that action is certainly enough to take any fish and be attractive to any fish. So I think articulated flies, especially when we're talking about large flies, have a real advantage simply because of their size more than their motion.
So it's a way to get a bigger pattern out there.
Yeah, it's like tying tube flies. You know, tube flies, you can achieve great size with tube flies with almost no weight because you're just using a small hook at the end, and the fly is tied entirely on the tube itself.
Interesting things happening with tube flies nowadays.
Oh, some fantastic stuff happening with tube flies, especially when you start talking about fishing in the salt and fishing for a lot of the tropical warm water species. You know, you need to throw flies sometimes that are 6 and 8 and 10 inches long, and that's pretty hard to achieve on a hook. So you can do that by making tube flies, tying them on a plastic tube, and you can throw an 8-inch long fly with an 8 weight with no problem at all.
Think there's going to be more of those designs used in streamer patterns for trout?
I'd like to see that.
Steelhead a lot, yeah?
Yeah, steelhead. People use them a lot for steelhead. I'd like to see it, but, you know, trout fishermen tend to be pretty hidebound and pretty traditional in the flies that they prefer to use. It's interesting, you take somebody that, you know, fly fishes for trout and they're going to be very traditional-minded, then you take that same person and take them steelhead fishing. You know, they may be using tube flies or fishing a nymph and an indicator. So we need to think about, and I recommend that people read about other forms of fishing other than the one they prefer. For example, if you just like to fish for trout, well, read about fishing for steelhead, read about fishing for pie otter in South America, and read about fishing, dry fly fishing for bass. All those will give you ideas not only for presentation, but potential flies you might be able to design. And also, I know this may sound like heresy, but we need to read about what the gear guys are doing. You know, fly fishermen tend to think that they're pretty sophisticated, but they've got absolutely nothing on the gear guys, especially since bass tournaments started. The gear guys are way more sophisticated in the gear that they use than fly fishermen are in the flies that they use. They've done experiments on color and experiments on sizes and shapes that would put the average fly fisher to shame. And if we would read some of that stuff and see what they're doing, it would give us more ideas and perhaps opportunities to build new and better and, you know, flies that can leap over tall buildings in a single bound and all that sort of stuff. Yeah.
So there's still room for improvement, you're saying, huh?
Oh, there's still room for improvement.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's amazing. After all these years, you'd think we'd have it down pat, but that's the wonder of nature in there as well.
Yeah,
changing
it's also
things
the
around.
Yeah, it's a wonder of the creative spirit of human beings, too. And as in about 1972, when Doug Swisher and Carl Richards wrote Selective Trout, they sort of triggered a rush to synthetics. I notice one of the questions that we have here is about synthetics and naturals. Well, synthetics will do things that natural materials just will not do, period, and are far superior in many ways than natural materials. Number one, they're cheaper. Number two, they're easier to get. Number three, you can dye them consistent colors that won't change. Number four, you can produce them in any fiber length or fiber diameter that you want. So you can make it as fine as the finest natural fur. You can make it as coarse as deer hair. You can make it 25 inches long. You can make it a quarter of an inch long. You can blend them. You can just do all sorts of amazing things with the new synthetic, not only fibers, but sheet materials and other kinds of things that have come onto the marketplace. And part of what's happened in the design revolution is this rush to synthetics and discovering all the things that they can do and the things that can be produced by utilizing those synthetics. Some of these flies are much more successful than their predecessors, and others maybe not, maybe any more successful at all. They just look cooler. You know, some of the old flies have been redesigned using new materials, and those do actually turn out to be better flies. For example, the wing on Parachute Adams, for example, is much better done with a sparkle material than it is done with a calf tail.
A synthetic, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. What about on the emergers? That was a question I saw here, too. Wings that's an emerging right there, but I was thinking more of the little tufts that are used, synthetic.
Yeah, there's a number of materials that have proven to be really effective for that. Of course, CDC, because of its floatability. CDC also is a very, you know, highly mobile material, if you want to call it that. You tie that on its little clump, and it just lays up there and waves and moves, so it looks sort of like an insect trying to wiggle out of its nymphal husk, plus it holds the fly up in the surface film. That's a really good material, as are any of the sparkle materials. when you look at an insect emerging, whether it doesn't matter whether it's a mayfly, a caddisfly, or a midge, coming out of its pupal husk or its nymphal husk, when it first comes up, the head comes out first, then the legs pop out, and the body and the wings are still sort of trapped back into in the husk. And so it just comes out as a peg. It just looks like a peg sticking up. That's what that wing of the parachute atoms represents. So when you look at it in the light, it does sort of sparkle a little bit. And so people have gone to using these SST and other kinds of sparkle materials, these antron-type filaments, trilobal materials, as that little post sticking up. And it has proved actually to be a better material to represent that emerging insect than natural materials like calf tail or deer hair or some of these other things that have been used, simply because it looks to the fish more like the real thing.
Yeah, something something wet in the sunlight kind of.
That's right.
Yeah. Question was here, why doesn't, you know, when you're thinking about it, even a dry fly or a nymph or any of the flies, why doesn't the hook itself scare off fish? Do they not see that? Do they look past it? Nobody seems
to
talk about that.
Yeah, actually, fish do see the hook. And depending upon the particular fly and the angle at which the fish is looking, that hook may or may not be important to the fish. You know, why would a fish not take a fly when there's a tiny piece of algae hanging on the hook and then take it when there's no algae hanging on the hook? Well, they're fish. That's the first answer. You know, second answer is...
IQ6, remember. Right?
Yeah, that's right. As soon as you stick a piece of algae on the hook, you've changed the entire design of the fly and the shape of the fly, and you've made something that wouldn't naturally be there. Of course, you could say the hook wouldn't naturally be there.
Right.
But the fish tend to overlook the hook as long as the profile of the hook is not too large. I'll give you a good for instance. If you fish a thin-bodied larval imitation in very clear water and lakes to cruisers that are near shore, and the hook gap is too large, the fish will simply refuse the fly. Because the gap of the hook relative to the size of the fly, the body diameter and all that kind of stuff, is way out of proportion. I've seen it many, many times. Fishing like a size 16 standard hook, they won't take it. You put on an 18 2X long, they'll take it every time. Simply because you've reduced the visibility of the bend and the point relative to the visibility of the design itself. Very, very interesting. Now, you'd wonder, you know, it's a good thing that fish don't have the eyesight of an eagle because they'd never take our flies. I mean, you got that big hook hanging out its butt and a big rope coming out of its nose hole, you know, and you might go, like, why would they ever take them? Well, fortunately, they do because, number one, the detail that they can see is not as good a detail as we can see. Second of all, when you look at a fly from underwater, talking about dry flies or emergers, oftentimes the hook itself is like a part of the body, depending upon the angle that you're looking from. And, you know, it can be right in line with the body. And when you look up at it, you don't even really see it as a hook. All you see it is a line in the body of the fly. Now, I wish there was some real easy explanation to say, well, they don't see it, you know, if it's a such and such and a so-and-so, but there really isn't any easy explanation. Other than observations that anglers have made over the years that, you know, well, if they're not taking the fly you want, put on a size smaller. Well, I discovered the reason for that when I was working on the nymphing video in 1982. We were shooting on Armstrong Spring Creek, and the nymphs, when you measured the nymphs, they were a size 16 nymph. Now, that was the measured on the shank length of the hook, so from behind the eye back to the bend where we normally would tie the fly. And yet, they'd take an 18 much easier than they'd take a 16. So, you know, it's like driving you nuts. And then I put a size 16 fly down into a little tank beside one of the nymphs, a pale morning dun nymph. You know, we were filming it. And immediately, as soon as I put it in there, I saw the reason why. The eye of the hook looks like the head of the nymph. And so now you have an insect that looks like it's a whole hook eye longer than the real insect. It looks much larger. And when you're talking about a size 16 hook, the eye is significant. It's probably 10% to 15% of the length of that front part of the hook. So as a consequence, the size 16 looked larger than the real nymph. So when you went to an 18, it looked like the size of the real nymph.
That leads into this question by John Sventina in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
Says, to get better hookups when fishing midges, can you tie number 20 fly bodies on a 16 hook? And here we go with talking about the hook being part of the size. That may or may not work.
Well, interestingly enough, when you get down to the small hooks, let's say size 20 and smaller, you can generally go to a 2X short shank, which people call wide gap hooks. They're either 2X short or they're 2X wide, depending upon how you want to look at it. Typically, fish will take those, and so you get a little bit better hookup. So in other words, you could fish a size 20, 2X short, which would actually be like an 18 hook. Let me back up again. You fish a size 18, 2X short, which would have the length of a 20, but the gap of an 18.
Mm-hmm.
But
I wouldn't tie
a size 20 on a 16 because the differential is too great.
Right.
Now, interestingly enough, you know, we're talking about fishing midges, especially where adults are involved. I knew George Griffith when he was still alive. He was one of the founding fathers of Trout Unlimited, but he was also the guy that developed the Griffith's Net. And his favorite fly size was a 16. And it turns out, everybody that I ever talked to about fishing Griffith's Net that have fished intensively all say that 16 is their favorite size. And you'd say, well, I'm fishing it in a size 20 midge hatch, and I'm fishing a size 16. Why is it so successful? It turns out, midges frequently will clump up on the surface of the water. There'll be one female and four or five males, all they're trying to mate with her, and so they form clumps that come down. And fish are used to seeing these clumps all the time. So you can fish a size 16 midge adult, this Griffith's Net, during a hatch when they're eating 20s, and they take the 16 just as well as they'd take a 20, simply because they're used to seeing the clumps coming down.
Yeah.
So again, we're talking here about insect behavior relative to fly design. I even have big Griffith's Nets, a size 12, that I fish as clump flies when I'm in a real heavy midge hatch, and they can be very successful.
Well, I need to take another break here real quick.
All right.
I've actually run over on my break time, so I'll be right back. Flats Time Charters is your sponsor for this segment of the show. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website at www.flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Gary Borger about designing trout flies. If you'd like to ask a question, go to our homepage, use that Q&A text box, and send us your question. We'll try to answer as many of them on the show tonight as possible. Gary, before we get back into things here, I do want to answer a couple of questions that came in, because I love it when people send them in live here. So even if they're out of order or whatever, let's try to address these. One of them is, I'm a Patty in Victorville, California. I'm a beginning fly fisherman fly tier, and my favorite place to fish is in Island Park, Idaho, and Mammoth Lakes, California. My question for you is, what types of flies do you recommend I start learning to tie? There are so many different types and supplies.
Well, if you're going to fish Island Park, I mean, you're talking about fishing Henry's Fork and those rivers around there. Maybe they're getting over to fish the Madison, that sort of thing. And if you're talking about going up to Mammoth Lake, then you're talking about, you know, lake flies. And lake flies can differ slightly than stream flies simply because they're different species in lakes. But, again, it depends on the time of the year that they're fishing and whether they're fishing opportunistic or selective times. I think for any beginning fly tier that they ought to begin focusing on tying different techniques and learning techniques that allow them to design flies to match the kinds of hatches that they're running into or other flies that they might see that people have that are successful and that sort of thing. For example, learn how to do wings. Learn how to do different body styles. Learn how to use loops. Learn how to tie with foam. Learn how to tie with different textures of materials. rather than focusing on a pattern, focus on technique and then use the techniques to help them develop patterns. One thing that you can do, anybody can do, is simply write to people that live in that area and say, hey, I'm going to be up there on June 23rd fishing on Henry's Fork, you know, what's the big hatch? And then you get a letter back that says, hey, we're going to have pale morning duns, we're going to have green drakes, we're going to have, you know, midges, we're going to have this particular caddis and so on, and then focus on learning to tie those particular flies. That's the probably the best answer to give, because if you're fishing lakes, you could learn how to tie leeches, you could learn how to tie snails, you could learn how to tie damselfly nymphs, you can learn how to tie mayfly nymphs, you can learn how to tie caddis pupae, because all those are in lakes, midges. You know, when you're fishing streams, the only difference between stream insects and lake insects is that in lakes you tend to have damsels and dragons, and in streams you tend to have stoneflies rather than damsels and dragons. Other than that, you have species that overlap in both of them, and you have certainly families that overlap. Certainly you have mayfly family, and you have, you know, caddises and midges in both. So rather than just learning to tie a particular fly, focus on learning technique that allow you to tie any style of fly and any kind of fly readily and easily, and then find out what it is that you're going to need for the time of year you're being there, going to be there, and then pound out flies for that particular time.
And many times, too, you can call or write the shops and order some flies right from the shop in that area.
Sure,
and they can send the patterns out, and you can duplicate them. And,
that's exactly right.
And tie those 10 different emerging patterns for the
pale
morning duns.
And, you know, fly designers, fly tires, a lot of times will not go in a shop and buy flies because, well, I tie my own. Well, for pity's sake, go in there and look and see what other people are tying. Maybe it'll give you some ideas, and you can create some new stuff, too.
Yeah.
You know, don't be so locked into the ways of thinking that your fly pattern happens to be the best one in the world, because it may or it may not be, depending upon. Yeah, there's lots
of
things going
on. Well, we've got another one that came online here, Steve Lamb, ATL, I guess, Atlanta. Can you get a patent on a fly you made? I design a lot of my own flies that work very well.
Sure. You can get a patent on anything. But you can't get a patent on a particular, on a fly that would be called a utility patent. A utility patent means you cover its use. You can't do that because flies have been around for 2,000 years, and you can't get a patent on a fly saying, I have a patent on a fly for catching trout. No, you can't do that. You can get a patent on a pattern, which is called a design patent. But anybody can change that design simply by changing the materials or changing the size of the tail or the size of the wing or something else. So getting a patent on a fly is, number one, very expensive, and number two, for the amount of money that you would get back in return for what it is that you've patented, probably would be very, very small. Now, you do have certain legal rights. For example, you have a legal right to your name. So if you call the fly your name, the something or other, then, you know, you can copyright that and have it protected. You could trademark that and have it protected. But somebody else could change the name a little bit, and then it wouldn't do you much good.
So it's pretty tough. But there are a lot of tires that are, what, licensing their patterns to, like, Umpqua or something?
Well, what they're really doing, you can't really license your pattern to anybody. I mean, what they're really doing is they're licensing their use of their name on that pattern.
Okay.
For example, how could you license something like the Royal Wolf? I mean, if Lee Wolf developed that, but nobody pays Lee Wolf any money for that, or Joan Wolf now since Lee's dead, nobody pays them any money for that. And yet, you know, Lee was the one that originated that whole style of flies, but nobody pays him any money. What they're really licensing is they're licensing that person's name relative to the fly. If once that fly is sold any place, if it's not patented, anybody can tie it.
Mm-hmm.
If it's published in a magazine any place, anybody can tie it, anybody can sell it. That's the law. Now, what fly tying companies have done is fly tying companies have said, aha, this person will be one of our professional on our professional design team. And that person's associated with these flies that they've developed. And this person is now developing more new flies for us, and so on. And that's really what's being paid for, not the fly design per se.
Well, more for the name of the individual that's well-recognized.
They're paying for the name of the individual and that person's design skills and the fact that that person supposedly came up with this fly, although a lot of times they don't come up with it, they borrow it from somebody else. But, you know, be that as it may, you can't really patent a fly without a tremendous amount of effort, tremendous amount of work, tremendous amount of money. Jim Tini had his father patented the Tini Nymph, but that thing had to be tied exactly the same way every time with exactly the same materials, and it had to have on it a tag with the patent number on it. Because if he sold it without a patent number and without a mark on it that it was patented, then he violates the patent rule. See, so yeah, it's one of those kind of things that everybody wants to make millions and millions of dollars off the fly pattern that they developed, and it's just not going to happen. The fact is that lots of people come up with the same idea that they had and could prove that they did. So what you're really doing is you're saying, I have lots of experience as a fly designer. My flies have been extremely successful. And, you know, I'm now working as a design person for these people, and they're paying me either a flat rate or royalty or something on the flies that I've designed and are going under my name. And I am
that would be his better approach is to approach.
That would be a much better approach, yep.
Yeah.
Much
he
better
wants
approach.
To get recognition and then recoup.
That's right. That's right.
Well, we've got running short on time here, but there are two questions that I would like to address here, the last two that are on the list that I sent over to you. One is by Chris Morris, Little Rock, Arkansas. In his local tailwaters, most are fishing beadheads on midges, sowbugs, nymphs, etc. What are the advantages, disadvantages, and adding a beadhead? And you had mentioned a few things about this earlier, but there are some people that are flat out against beadheads, and some people that won't fish any fly without them, it seems. So what's your take on it, Gary?
Well, beadheads do basically two things. Number one, they provide flash at depth. Number two, they give you depth. Most people that had never done well nymph fishing caught a lot of fish on beadheads for the simple reason that they were fishing deeper than they'd ever fished in their life. You put a beadhead on, it goes to the bottom. You know, so they're fishing right down on the right on the bottom. Now, you got to remember where beadheads came from. They didn't come from the United States. These are European-designed flies. And Theo Bacalar is the guy that actually brought the gold beadhead flies into the United States and made them popular here. And those flies basically originated in Eastern Europe, in the waters there in Serbia and places like that, Poland and other places, where they're fishing small flies in very, very clean water, with high gradients, very little vegetation, big rocks, and a lot of gravel. And they're fishing flies that they need to get right on the bottom. They're fishing 14, 16, 18s, and 20s. They're using what's called the rolled nymph technique, in which they fish a very, very heavy nymph, a dropper, and then this very small fly behind it. The big fly is so heavy that when they chuck it in the water, it just sits on the bottom. And then they use about a 12-foot rod and a leader hanging out the end, and then they literally pull the big fly downstream. The small fly, of course, goes along with it. Well, if a fish takes the small fly because they're pulling the big one, it sets the hook instantaneously. It's a lethal technique, absolutely lethal. But the beadhead was developed to get the fly deep and give it a little bit of flash, so when this 16 or 18 came by, the fish went, oh, what's that? Boom, and took it. Beadheads can be overused. There are some waters, for example, in Colorado, where they want the fly tying companies to manufacture the flies with tarnished beads rather than with the bright beads, simply because fish have seen so many bright beads and are coming by all the time that they sort of started avoiding them. But they'll take the ones with the darker beads because the flies are getting down on the bottom and the darker bead looks a little bit more like a natural insect. Okay. Beadheads do definitely have a place in nymph fishing. They really do.
So in your development over the years, it sounds like you're not a purist of sorts, that you're, again, more opportunistic as a fly tyer in using, whether it be natural, whether it be synthetic, whether it be beads or no beads, or whatever's best for the moment, so to speak. Is that correct?
Yeah, the charm of fly fishing to me is problem solving. and being able to catch a lot of fish once you figure it out. So I'm not going to dismiss any technique, and I'm not going to dismiss any design concept. I'm not going to dismiss any materials. I want to explore all of those, because the more I know about all those things, the better I'll be as an angler in any kind of situation, whether it be for trout or pike or bass or, like I say, the saltwater species, a tropical or temperate warm water species, any of those. And I think, I think it behooves any fly designer, if they're serious about designing, to look into every single possible thing that they can and explore how those things actually work.
And that's half the fun, is the creative
Absolutely.
Aspect of that and the problem-solving
Absolutely.
Aspect of it. Yeah, yeah. And the last question, Bob, and we always get one because this is a little different show, but Bob Tieden in Smithfield, Rhode Island, kind of captured it. It's always, well, what's the go-to fly? He wants to know what your go-to box is for trout.
You
had one box. What would be the flies that you would put in it for trout?
Whooey, that's a tough one. And the reason I say it's tough is because, you know, are we fishing selectively or are we fishing opportunistically? I mean,
well,
I don't know
because you're just leaving the house and you've got to take that one box.
Yeah.
You don't know what's going to happen out there.
I mean, there are certain flies that you could pick that would allow you to do a wide variety of things. For example, we've already talked about the universal emerger, so you could throw a parachute Adams in there anywhere from a size 10 all the way down to a size 22 or 24, and that could be extremely useful in any hatch. You'd always be able to match enough of the hatch to be able to take a few fish. And if you clip the wing off the top, you can turn it into a spinner pattern. So, you know, it's a sort of a near enough kind of thing that you can match up a lot of flies with it. Of course, a Griffith's gnat. You can trim a Griffith's gnat off the bottom and turn it into an emerger. You can trim a Griffith's gnat off the bottom and top and a little bit on the back and turn it into a tiny spinner. I mean, I've done all this kind of stuff before. I would certainly take some big leech-style patterns. Whether you use woolly buggers or whether you use some of the other newer kind of leech styles that are coming out now, collared leeches and those sorts of things, something that will allow you an opportunity to go for a big fish during dark hours, morning, early, you know, late evening, after dark, or even during the middle of the day if you've got opportunities of rain or overcast sky or a little rising water or something to pound some big fish. And then you ought to have probably some nymphs like gold-ribbed hare's ear, maybe some rusty brown colored nymphs, and certainly some small stuff like pheasant tails, maybe some little brassies or RS2s or some other little beadhead zebra midges and a few things like that that allow you to fish deep. In other words, what I'd be taking if I only had one box is I'd take a wider range of flies as I possibly could, and I'd try to pick the flies that would give me the most opportunity to do different things. Now, I have some flies, for example, that I would put in there that nobody's ever even seen. For example, I'd take a hook and just spin a deer hair or a synthetic material in a dubbing loop and wrap it on the hook and just take it exactly like that. It's just a funny-looking little fuzzball. But I can trim that one on the top and sides and turn it into a scud. I can trim it on top and bottom and turn it into a crest bug. I can trim it on the bottom and shape it just a little bit and turn it into a dry fly. I know a caddis imitation. I can trim it on the back and top and bottom and turn it into a spinner imitation. I could trim it on the back a little bit and trim the wing in the front and turn it into a mayfly done, and just all sorts of things that you can do with those kind of things.
Back to the impressionistic.
That's right, and that comes from design experience, but also experience of knowing what it is that fish are taking when they're on the river and what they're looking for. It'd be really hard to say, you know, these are the 10 best flies in the whole world for trout, simply because trout are biological organisms and they'll fool you every time. You know,
you mentioned a lot of the good old standbys. Which,
yes, absolutely. They work.
They've been around for years, and there's been a reason they've been around for years.
That's exactly right. I mean, elk hair caddis. You couldn't take a box of flies any place without an elk hair caddis stuffed in there.
Yeah.
Simply because that the fish are receptive to that particular style. And if you think about it, in the last few seconds that we have, since we're talking about designing, that tells you something. It tells you that those flies have achieved the ultimate goal, and that is representing what it is the fish actually see. You can take that information and then use that kind of a concept and move it over into other food groups if you want to, and begin developing flies that way. I mean, nothing but a body of hackle and deer hair wing, and fish will take that thing 10-1 over almost anything else most of the time.
Very good. Well, unfortunately, we got to wrap things up, Gary. But when we return, we're going to give away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and also a 1-year subscription to to Fly Fusion Magazine. So everybody stay tuned to see if you win. The largest and most prestigious fly fishing competition in the United States, National Fly Fishing Championship, is taking place as we speak in Colorado. In fact, today was the first day of the championship, and we'll go through the end of this week into Saturday. The National Fly Fishing Championship is sponsored by Colorado Trout Unlimited and the fly fishing industry, and involves teams from different regions of the country, Fly Fishing Team USA, and international competitors. The payoff is gold, silver, and bronze medals, and an opportunity to be selected as a member of Team USA, who will represent our country in the 2008 World Championships in New Zealand. Volunteers are needed, and interesting parties may apply online or find out more about going and watching these expert fly fishers fish. And you can do that at several locations, and the maps are out at the website, which is www.nationalflyfishingchampionship.com. Again, www.nationalflyfishingchampionship.com. And the venues for this year are just outside up in the mountains from Boulder, Colorado. So if you're in the area, check that out. Tonight I want to also officially announce the launch of Ask About Fly Fishing blog. You can view our blog by selecting blog at the top, on the top line menu of our website, or by going to www.askaboutflyfishing.com/blog. I want to encourage all of you to join the conversation on the blog. Feel free to leave your comments about our topics and let us know what you think about the issues at hand. First topic we posted out there is on water access rights. Let us know what the water access rights are in your part of the world, because we know they differ from state to state, province to province, country to country. Give us your opinion on tell us what they are in your part of the world, and give us your opinion on whether you think they're fair or not, or if you think they could be improved, tell us what your solution might be. Don't be shy. Just click on the link labeled comments below the blog and let us know what your thoughts are. We'd really enjoy having you join in the conversation. Well, just a quick reminder for everybody before you leave our website tonight, just take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on the homepage in Gary's section that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate that. And so now it's time to give away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And we do this based upon the registration database that we get from you people registering. If you haven't registered by now, it's a little late, but be sure and register for next show. And we've always given away great gifts. So let's do the drawing for the 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And our first winner there is Nestor Monlor, it looks like. Nestor Monlor in Florida. And congratulations, Nestor. And I'm sure you'll enjoy your membership to the Federation, as I do. Gary does. And the second gift we're going to give away is the Fly Fusion magazine. And that goes to William Gale. William Gale. And he's in California. So congratulations to both of you. That's you're both getting great, great gifts, and I know you'll enjoy them. Well, Gary, let's see if they paid attention here, okay?
All right.
We want to know, how about, what is the best color for a subsurface fly? If you're going to pick one color, what might that color be based upon what Gary said tonight? Now, if you type that color in, be sure you put your name and your location in on the text box so that we know who it is that sent the answer, and the first one through will get that $20 gift certificate at Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado, which you can redeem on their website for merchandise as well. So we're looking for that one color, folks. Just type it in, send it through with your name and your location, and we'll see if we get a winner here. Oh, I don't know. This guy, Ted Hasselbrink, says purple. What do you think, Gary?
Well, purple is a good one, but that, yeah, try again.
Yeah, try again. That wasn't quite it. Fluorescent red, Earl Scheinberg in St. Louis.
Well,
not what I was thinking.
Fluorescent red's good, but if you're going to pick one, it's still not right.
Oh, we got fluorescent red again. Must have made an impact on that. Three fluorescent reds.
Yeah.
Deep red. Oh, they're coming in fast and furious now. Ah, here we go. I think this is the answer, but you tell me, Gary. How about Jack Grover in Boise, Idaho with black?
Hey, there you go.
There's our winner, Jack Grover, Boise, Idaho with black, is always a go-to color for subsurface. So, Jack, be sure to email or just type in the text box there again and send it back over with your name and your email address so that I can contact you after the show so that we can get your gift certificate to you. So congratulations, Jack. That was quite the flurry of answers, but that fluorescent red is also a color that we'd want to look at as well out there too. So, well, Gary, hey, we really appreciate you being with us tonight. It's always a pleasure to talk with a Borger.
Yes, my pleasure.
Enjoyed your son last time, and just a wealth of information from you too. And thanks for taking time to share your experiences with us.
You're very welcome, Roger.
Yeah, and hopefully we can talk again sometime. And like you said, there's a lot of things you can talk about, and hopefully we can get you back and do just that. Have a nice chat again.
We'll be able to do that.
All righty. Sounds good.
Great.
Well, our next broadcast will be on October 17th, and at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And that show, we're going to interview Tad Burke, and our topic for the show will be tangling with tarpon. Those that have fished for the tarpon say it's addicting. I can bear witness to that. So if you dare, join Tad, a professional guide in the Florida Keys, and learn his secrets about hooking up with a tarpon and staying hooked. Well, we'd like to thank Keeney's Fly Shop, Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, Flats Times Charters, and the National Fly Fishing Championship for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.